It is definitely a challenge for a startup leader to understand what it's going to require in terms of your own personal leadership abilities and what the environment is going to require from you in terms of managing a much larger, much more complex, much more complicated organization, and the ability to be honest with yourself about whether or not that's where you want to go. Most people say they want to grow, but I've found that oftentimes it's be careful what you ask for because you may get it. And some people find themselves, when they get what they ask for, they're lost, they're bewildered, they're in a world of hurt and don't know how to get out of it.
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOcoachingInternational.com. Your business is made up of five powerful elements, but you won't experience explosive growth until you have them in complete alignment. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky. My guest today is Greg Martin. Greg is an entrepreneur, CEO, private equity investor, and a coach here at CEO Coaching International. He has an extraordinary track record of having led four separate companies onto the Inc. 5000 list while achieving growth rates of over 6,000%. Combined, his businesses have generated more than $3 billion in revenue, created over 2,500 jobs, and resulted in two high eight-figure exits. In today's show, we discuss one of the most critical aspects of business success, which is how do you align vision, mission, culture, strategy, and execution to drive massive results? With that, please enjoy my conversation with Greg Martin. As I was preparing for this conversation, I noticed that you are a competitive road cyclist, a former ski racer, a private pilot, and an avid international fresh and saltwater fly fisherman. So I'd love for you to share one thing that you learned from each of those pursuits that has helped shape you to be the leader that you are today.
That is a litany of expensive hobbies I've put together over the years, Steve. Yeah, cycling was an outgrowth of skiing. So let's start with skiing. I grew up skiing, grew up in the mountains of Utah, so was a skier from a very young age. And the thing I learned in ski racing is that fractions of a second matter in ski racing, and writ large, small things add up to big things. That's my takeaway from ski racing. The shortest line between two points is generally the winner of a ski race, but that shortest line has a lot of inputs that make it the shortest line. And that's true in life as well. You often see simplicity and you think, boy, that person's really got it figured out. But there's generally a lot of complexity in between what happened on that side and what now looks like simplicity. So those are a couple of my big takeaways from ski racing. I got into cycling really as off-season training for ski racing, but really fell in love with road cycling. And the thing I learned from road cycling is, particularly in a race, is to learn how to draft. Because when you're drafting, you're expending 30% less energy than when your nose is in the wind. So it's a really critical skill to learn when to be on the front and when to be relying on the efforts of others to get you where you want to be in a race. And again, the metaphor tracks pretty well over to life as well. There are times when you need to have your nose in the wind, and there are times when you rely on the strength of others to help you get you to your goals. Fly fishing is a relatively solitary pursuit, and it is the one thing I do that allows me to completely disconnect from pressures, just from the day-to-day grind of life. So again, thinking about that as a metaphor, finding something, whether that's meditation or exercise or any number of things that can serve as a pressure valve, particularly for leaders who are in high stakes situations on a daily basis, is really critical to your kind of mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual health. And I don't mean that in a religious context. I just mean that in feeding your spirit and your soul and finding activities that feed that part of the whole person. Flying is a jealous mistress and something that you do not want to take lightly, meaning flying at its best is hours and hours of kind of non-eventful activity, sometimes punctuated by really anxious moments. Hopefully those anxious moments are fewer and fewer as you get better at flying. But the thing I learned from flying is that you have to be on guard and paying attention every single second you're sitting behind the control wheel. And as a CEO, that's your job. Your job is to be the one who's paying attention. Obviously, you have people like air traffic control who are helping you. Unlike ski racing, where you're trying to take the shortest line between A and B, you're trying to do that in flying as well. But because the wind is blowing and you don't control the wind, you're always making course corrections constantly. Flying is a series of course corrections, and that's true in business as well. I found that as I sat in the CEO chair over a 35-year career, I was constantly making course corrections. And if I wasn't, it was likely that I was getting blown off course. So that's the lesson that I learned from flying. I hope I haven't missed any of my expensive hobbies. I think that's all of them.
In addition to those pursuits, you've had a pretty amazing business career. You've led four companies onto the Inc. 5000 list. You've been a two-time EY Entrepreneur of the Year finalist. You've had a couple of really big exits here. So let's talk about business. Let's talk about some of the lessons that you've learned over this stellar career. What are some things that we need to keep in mind, or what are some of the common attributes of the best-run companies?
Obviously, a sports fan, given how many of my pursuits are physical and sports related. And I'm a big Olympics fan, a big supporter of the US Olympic team, and just a big advocate of sports in general. And most people know that there are five Olympic rings. Not everybody knows what those rings are symbolic of. They're symbolic of the five continents who send athletes to the Olympic Games. But there are also, at least in my experience, there are five circles that all of the best companies pay a lot of attention to. And those five are vision, mission, culture, strategy, and execution. Now, most people have seen the Olympic rings on a single plane, but it's interesting to think about those five rings in business in three dimensions. And I like to think about them in a vertical stack. And the top of that stack is vision, then mission, then culture, then strategy, then execution. And the more that a business and a leader is able to align those circles, in other words, to make those circles as concentric as possible, if this were a Venn diagram, there'd be one circle instead of five circles. The alignment of those five elements, again, in my experience as a CEO and in making big happen, has been when I have been able to most closely align those five elements. Now, if you think about those five individually, Steve, obviously you're not going to hamper or rejigger or pivot your vision. Generally, you set a vision for the company. It may have some minor tweaks over time, but vision is one of the five elements that generally stays fairly constant over the life of a business. And mission, as a derivative of that vision, which lies in support of that vision, also tends to be fairly constant. Again, the competitive environment is constantly changing, so some minor modifications to mission may be needed over the course of a business life cycle, but fairly constant again and aligned with the vision. Now, how do you get to your vision and your mission? You get to that through the three elements that are underneath that, beginning with culture. Now, there's the famous quote that most people are familiar with, the Drucker quote, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." So, culture is a really important element of supporting your vision and your mission. In other words, Jim Collins calls it getting the right people in the right seats on the bus. These are all just different ways of saying that culture matters, and it really does matter. I read an interesting statistic just the other day. There was a survey that said effective onboarding increases retention by up to 80%. So culture really begins at onboarding. It begins with the interview process. It begins with the way you present your public face to the world and how you attract and retain talent. And most businesses, except for virtual businesses, are made up of people. And getting the right people in the right seats, doing the right activities that are in support of the mission and the vision are the underpinnings of a great, durable culture that can become a competitive advantage. One of those businesses that you mentioned that I led onto the Inc. 5000, which won a couple of workplace awards, we were so focused on mission because it was imperative that people who came and became a part of our team understood at a very fundamental level why we did what we did the way we did. And so we were very careful and very cautious and very thoughtful in the interviewing and onboarding process to ensure that we brought people onto that team who understood exactly what we were about and why we were about it. Oftentimes, people might think that's most important in a nonprofit setting, but I would argue that it's absolutely as critical for the people that you bring onto your team to buy into your vision and your mission in a very profound way. Maybe some of the listeners have read the book Drive and understand that unless you're building widgets in a widget factory, paying people more for producing more widgets, that only works with very manual labor. And people are looking for more, particularly in a professional environment, than just getting paid more. They want a sense of being a part of something larger than themselves, which in business tend to be the vision and the mission. So finding people who are a great cultural fit is so valuable and so important. And the opposite is also true, Steve. If you get the culture wrong, it's really hard, if not impossible, to accomplish your mission and your vision. That's how important getting that right is. Then we go down to strategy and execution. Mike Tyson, he probably has the most famous quote about strategy, which is, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And most people who have been involved in strategy sessions know that the outside environment waits for no one. And as soon as the ink is dry on your strategic plan, something either in the external environment has changed or something internally may have changed. And it's like flying. It's why I use the metaphor of constant course corrections. Strategy is really a series of constant course corrections. It's knowing what to say yes to and what to say no to. It's understanding the difference between what's important and what's not important. It's understanding the difference between a shiny object that looks exciting but is not really going to get you closer to where you're trying to go. And then it's a series of constant course corrections to ensure that you get there. And that's what execution is. Execution is those series of constant course corrections based on effective, ongoing communication that keeps your team aligned. So again, if you think of these stacked in a vertical plane, the execution supports the strategy, supports the culture, supports the mission, supports the vision.
You mentioned that vision is at the top of the stack. So I'd love to hear an example of a vision, could be from one of your companies. And do you think of the vision as like a BHAG or a huge outrageous target that's a numerical goal that might be more inward facing? Or do you view the vision as an outward facing for the public, for clients, for customers? Could it be both? How do you think about that?
I view it in more than one dimension. I think the best examples of vision, Steve, are ones that create a North Star for the company. In other words, what are we tracking towards? What is our North Star? Whether that is a revenue goal, whether that is a impact, some kind of social impact or economic impact goal. But a vision has to serve as an inspiration to the leadership team, obviously, but also it has to inspire those people who've joined your team. Again, I mentioned the book Drive. People want to be part of something larger than themselves. So a compelling vision is something that will inspire people. They think, I want to be a part of that. That's meaningful. That motivates me. That gets me out of bed in the morning and makes me excited to come to work and do what I do on a daily basis for 8 or 10 hours a day. It animates the work. So vision really has to infuse itself throughout the organization, get people excited, inspire them, keep them motivated, and keep them focused on, like I said, on that company North Star, or that business North Star.
So we've got these five elements, and you say we can think of them like these concentric circles and the Venn diagram where they're going to overlap. So how do we do that? How do we align these five elements as a leader?
So we really start from the bottom up. I mentioned communication earlier. The basic element, or the unit of one, if you will, in ensuring that these circles align is communication. And generally, that communication has to be formalized. Ad hoc communication is great. It's become more challenging now in kind of both the virtual and the hybrid world. I earned the gray hair on my head most of my career. The vast majority was spent pre-COVID, when everybody went to an office and worked shoulder to shoulder in an office every single day. I grew up in an environment of water cooler, hallway, break room, chat. It's just what you did. Obviously, there were times when you spoke about kind of the sports results from the last weekend or what movie you just seen, but often those were business related chats around the water cooler or in the break room. And a lot of really interesting ideas and innovative ideas over the course of my career came out of some of those ad hoc or informal conversations. But those aren't enough. You need a formal communication protocol to really ensure that you get these circles to overlap. And again, the basic fundamental unit is the one-on-one. So every frontline manager should be having a weekly one-on-one with his or her direct reports. Generally, the best practice is for the direct report to bring the agenda. In other words, the manager doesn't set the agenda. It's best if you let your direct report set that agenda. And that does a couple of things. Number one, it helps you know what's on their mind, what's important to them, what's top of mind for them. And number two, it's training for them to do the same thing when they become a manager. When they become a manager, they're going to switch roles and they're going to let their direct reports then bring the agenda to the meeting. Another great rule of thumb is the 75-25 or 80-20 rule. You should spend, as the manager, 75 or 80% of your time should be spent listening. Only 20% of your time should be spent talking. But again, using that fundamental building block and ensuring that each of those managers is having a weekly one-on-one, and then those managers are having a weekly one-on-one with their direct reports. And so it goes up to the CEO, who's having a weekly one-on-one with his direct reports. So that fundamental building block of that formal one-on-one communication, which I borrowed from John Doerr's book about objectives and key results, OKRs, that he learned from Andy Grove, that has been, over the course of my career, the fundamental building block of ensuring that communication gets from the top all the way to that frontline person that you mentioned.
You mentioned the water cooler. You're talking about the importance of communication here. So let's take this to a real-time example. So as we're having our conversation today, Amazon is in the news again. The CEO, Andy Jassy, recently sent out a memo to everyone and said, you need to come back to the office 5 days a week. What advice, what counsel do you give to CEOs as they struggle, as they wrestle with what is going to be our office policy?
I'm a 100% supporter of Andy Jassy's decision to compel, I guess is the right word, people, Amazon employees, back to the office. I believe that Andy Jassy is a proponent of what I said about the importance of those informal kind of ad hoc meetings and the business results that come often as a result of those informal ad hoc meetings that just didn't happen on Zoom or aren't happening when people are working in their PJs in their living rooms or their bedrooms. But I also know that many employees, particularly knowledge workers, got very used to the flexibility of either remote or hybrid work. In fact, I have heard multiple examples of folks who have actually left businesses because the business had a return to work policy and they found an opportunity that was either remote or hybrid. So it's clear that many employees have become enamored of the opportunity to work remote or hybrid. What's the tail and what's the dog? Is the tail the company and its needs, or is the tail the employee who wants to work remotely? That's a crass way, maybe, of saying, I think the needs of the corporation, the needs of the business, in this case, trump the needs of the individual. And so you may find yourself faced with being an unpopular CEO who's requiring a return to work, But again, over 35 years, my experience has been that there just is no substitute for the power of in-person collaboration.
You mentioned being an unpopular leader. Now, obviously, as a CEO, you're going to have to make some unpopular decisions over the course of your tenure. In your experience, what have you found to be the best way as the CEO, as the leader, to communicate bad news? Perhaps you have to deliver a performance review and deliver some constructive feedback. How do you do that in such a way that it's received in the way that you're trying to deliver it?
It is a real challenge. For those of your listeners who are familiar with DISC, I'm a very high D. I generally don't tend to pull punches and communicate very clearly and shoot straight. But I know that not everybody likes to get their news, particularly if the performance feedback isn't all A's across the board or all 10s. Sometimes people don't enjoy hearing that less than favorable news. But I really have found that being honest and being open and explaining the rationale behind either what went into the performance review summary or what the kind of inputs were that created the bad news, if bad news needs to be delivered. I've resigned myself to the fact that as clearly as I communicate, it's not a guarantee that 100% of the listeners are going to line up and go, "That's great. I get it. I understand. I'm on board. No issue with me." That's just not how human nature works. There are always going to be detractors and naysayers, but the responsibility of the leader is to deliver the unvarnished news in the most concise, clear, and compelling way possible.
It's clear that communication is the glue, I think, that is helping hold all of this alignment together among these five elements. Walk me through how you think communication from the leader should evolve over time as the company grows. So, if the company's got 25 to 50 people, you're going to know everybody. It's pretty easy to communicate. But then you get 500 people, 5,000 people, it's going to change. How does that evolve over time?
I'm sure most of your listeners know that there are far more examples of leaders who are not able to transition from that small company environment to a large company environment than there are the reverse. The blockbuster examples would be a Bill Gates or a Steve Jobs who started Microsoft and Apple, respectively. Steve left but came back. But two entrepreneurs who started those businesses and were able to retain that CEO seat all the way to growing them into multi-billion dollar enterprises. You don't hear a lot of other examples. Andy Jassy's predecessor, obviously, Jeff Bezos did the same at Amazon. But other than those blockbuster examples, the number of people who are unable, leaders who are unable to make that transition from small to big are plentiful. Why is that? I've often asked myself that question. I think there are a few reasons, not just one reason, a few reasons. Some people just are much more comfortable in a startup environment. They're comfortable in firefighting mode. I've started a number of businesses and it is a constant firefight. It is every single day something different. And distinguishing between the urgent and the important is not always easy or straightforward. But a good leader learns how to discriminate between those two. And some leaders just are not able to make the transition from that small company feel, well, to use your example, they knew everybody on a first name basis, to having multiple functions within that organization, those functions having multiple departments within those functions, and not knowing who everyone is on a first name basis. My very first business that I started, it was a challenge when I made that transition from knowing everybody's name to not knowing everybody's name. It was also an interesting transition because we had a combination of white collar and blue collar workers in that organization. So culturally, there were some interesting dynamics. We had a warehouse and then we had an office in front. So people dressed up in the office and people didn't dress up in the warehouse. So, in addition to some folks just being more comfortable in that startup environment, I also think there are people who there's a well-known book called The Peter Principle, and people just tend to get tapped out. They're maybe a great, effective leader at running a $10 million business, but a $50 million or $100 million business just is beyond their skill set. They either haven't grown that skill set organically, or they haven't figured out a way to bring that skill set to them by additional education or mentoring or any of the other ways that you can improve your leadership capability. And they tap out or they tap themselves out. So it is definitely a challenge for a startup leader to understand what it's going to require in terms of your own personal leadership abilities and what the environment is going to require from you in terms of managing a much larger, much more complex, much more complicated organization, and the ability to be honest with yourself about whether or not that's where you want to go. Most people say they want to grow, but I've found that oftentimes it's be careful what you ask for, because you may get it. And some people find themselves, when they get what they ask for, they're lost, they're bewildered, they're in a world of hurt and don't know how to get out of it.
As the company grows, along with the CEO really needing to grow as the company grows, what about the culture? So again, let's go back to, you've got an organization of, let's say, 50 people, and that has a culture. And then you wake up one day and all of a sudden it's 500 or 5,000. How should the culture evolve over time as the company grows? How can we, or do we want to maintain culture as the company grows, or do we want to evolve the culture as it grows rapidly?
I think at a fundamental level, if you get the culture right, it should adapt and grow and evolve as your organization adapts and grows and evolves. In other words, I would say it is unlikely, if not absolutely impossible, for a culture to undergo a significant transformation from a smaller company environment to a larger company environment. In other words, the cultural touchstones are fairly consistent. That's why I mentioned vision, mission, and culture are generally pretty fixed in place. And there's a reason for that. One of the other reasons is if the culture evolves in a way that some of the early employees, or the way that you sold the culture to employees, they don't recognize that culture anymore. There's a disconnect between what the culture was and what it's evolving to. That's a huge red flag and a big danger sign in my experience. So if you get the kind of the cultural totems, if you get the North Stars of your culture right, that culture should evolve and adapt regardless of the size and the scale of the enterprise. Now, is it going to be completely and wholly unchanged? No, that's not the argument I'm making, but it's not going to be fundamentally undergoing a transformation. It's just going to be flexing as the organization grows.
In some respect, I think of culture as a thing or a structure that people can adapt to. So, A, if you agree with that, what are things that the leader and actually every team member can physically do, or structures that can be put in place that reinforce the culture such that if a new person comes into the organization, the new person is going to be shaped by the culture as opposed to the new person shaping the culture?
My experience has been that as the companies that I have led have undergone massive growth, we're talking thousands of percents of growth over 5-year periods. Obviously, we didn't grow our employee headcount in the thousands of percent. It wouldn't have made very much business sense. But we did absolutely grow our employee base dramatically during those hyper growth periods. So we were always really careful. And our ultimate goal and objective was to design the culture in a way that we were able to go from what I call push to pull. In other words, when you're a new company and you're starting out and you're growing, getting people to join your business, your enterprise, your vision is mostly a push exercise, meaning we're going to hire a recruiter, or we're going to have our own recruiters, or we're going to broadcast to the world, hey, we've got open positions and we'd like you to apply. Done right, culture tends to pull people who are attracted to the culture and the vision and the mission, because they either know somebody who works for the company, and the person who works for the company has said really positive and glowing things about the business and how much they enjoy working there and how much they enjoy working with the people who work there. or they've read about the company, there's been something published, or they've otherwise heard about the company. And again, done right, you can go from needing to push to find people to pull, because people raise their hand and go, if you ever have an opening, I'm interested. I love what your company does. I love how your people who work there talk about your business. So that's the magic, the special sauce, if you will, of culture, is designing it in a way that it acts as a magnet to attract like-minded people who want to join, who are actively engaged in telling you, yes, bring me on board as soon as you have an opening. That's the key, in my opinion, Steve.
It's clear that things don't always go according to plan. So, as we think about these five elements, what happens when one or more of them are out of alignment? How do we bring them back into alignment?
First, it's having the clear-eyed ability to analyze what's out of alignment, being honest with yourself, being honest with what's going on either internally or in the macro environment that's caused that misalignment to take place. Generally, that takes the form of a gap analysis. Where are we? Where do we need to be? What's in that gap, and how do we fill it? Based on my experience, Steve, it's fairly uncommon, atypical, that you would have a big miss, let's call it, in either your vision or your mission. It's possible. The world could change so dramatically that a mission may be rendered irrelevant, I suppose. That's a possibility. But generally, where those misalignments take place is culture, strategy, and execution. So, again, have a clear-eyed ability to analyze what's gone off track, to do the gap analysis, and then to define how we close that gap. Is it one of those circles? Is it more than one of those circles? If it's one circle, how do we go about closing that gap? If it's a multitude of circles, what's the interplay between those circles that have caused that misalignment? Don't treat symptoms. Treating symptoms is not going to alleviate your pain. You've got to get to the root cause. Having an ability, both yourself and to get your senior team involved to help you. We'll go back to the bicycle analogy. This may be a time where you need to use the draft to get behind some other strong cyclists and get them to help you do that analysis, and then to figure out how you're going to intervene in a way that's going to get those circles back into alignment.
Do you have an example, either from one of the companies that you've led or perhaps another company that we all might be familiar with, where one or more of these circles did get out of alignment? And then what did the organization do to get back into alignment?
One of my first businesses, there was a regulatory change, again, completely outside of our control. But because of that regulatory change, we needed to pivot our strategy. And I enlisted everybody to say, okay, here's what the regulatory environment looked like pre-change. Here's what the regulatory environment looks like now. That's caused a gap in our strategy. We were marching in the direction of the existing regulatory environment. Now we've got to pivot and move to be in compliance with the new regulatory requirement. And the great thing about it, Steve, was that the leadership team rose to the challenge. They were all right there with me. They were all on board with burning brain cells to figure out, okay, we've got to face reality. What are we going to do? And I was so proud of the leadership team for coalescing around the new reality. And we came up with a plan and executed that plan, ended up really not missing a beat. I think I can't remember exactly, but I'm going to say our revenue based on pre-regulatory change strategy, what our revenue goal for that year and what it was post-change was within 5%. And had we not had that clear-eyed approach and that all hands on deck, let's figure this out, let's pivot, let's move, who knows how big that miss would have been?
Let's try and pull all this together. So, can you share a story or an example? Again, could be a company that you led or another company that we're familiar with that has done a great job of keeping these five elements in alignment. And what was the impact on growth? What was the impact on performance? What was the impact on team members, customers, clients?
Two Bain consultants a number of years ago wrote a book, and one of the findings in that book was that in any relevant competitive market, there are generally five to seven competitors who share about 90% of the profit pool. So define an industry, look at the total revenue and the total kind of profit or EBITDA in that industry. Generally, five to seven companies are competing for 90% of that profit pool. The top two competitors in any of those relevant industries share the almost 70% of that 90%. Why is that? That's because they are the most nimble, the most agile, and the most aligned along those five dimensions. It seems like a secret, but there's no secret. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. That's why not all of those competitors are getting an equal share of the profit pool. They're just not configured in the same way, either on one or multiple of those dimensions that we've been talking about. They're just not configured the same way as those top two companies are that are sharing the lion's share of the profit pool amongst the two of them. And generally, even between one and two, there's quite a delta in the share of the profit pool. And we're talking the total industry profits. So to the victor goes the spoils. And the victor in most of these categories that we're talking about are the one or two best competitors. And the one or two best competitors, in my opinion, are the one who have figured out and nailed the alignment amongst these five elements.
Greg, as we get ready to wrap up here, is there any final thought, comment, or observation that you want to share about these five elements?
I am a student of business. I am a student of management. I am a student of companies who have distinguished themselves in their competitive markets. I'm a voracious reader. I love reading books about business successes and about business failures. I've learned as much or more from failures as I have from successes. But I am convinced beyond persuasion, Steve, that the alignment of these five elements, that getting those circles as concentric as possible through the rhythms that we have talked about, embedding the communication in the operating rhythm of the business, making sure that the people on the team are all in on the culture and on the vision and on the mission. That's how you distinguish your business. That's how you become one of the two companies that splits 70% of the profit pool in your competitive space.
I've got two final quick questions I want to ask you. So one is, you just mentioned books here, so I can't let you leave here without giving me one or two book recommendations.
So as I have gotten older, what mattered to me most when I was younger, it's pretty much the same, but it's not exactly the same. So there's a book by Clayton Christensen called How Will You Measure Your Life? So John Doerr wrote Measure What Matters. I mentioned that book earlier in our conversation. That's one of my favorites. But How Will You Measure Your Life? I found to be a very compelling read. Just one of those books that made me stop and think deeply about what was important to me and what really mattered. So Measure What Matters, How Will You Measure Your Life? Measurement seems to be a theme there. But I actually just got a third book that someone recommended. It's on my desk right now, called What the CEO Wants You to Know by Ram Charan, a fairly well-known author. And it's a quick read, but it's a really interesting read for CEOs. And I'd recommend it to all CEOs. It won't take you very long to read it, but there are some very interesting insights in Ram Charan's book.
And the last question I want to ask you here is, you're a coach here at CEO Coaching International. Talk to me about how you think about coaching. What are you trying to accomplish with your coaching clients? Do you have a coaching philosophy per se?
The last business, which I was involved in over the last 4.5 years, one of my primary responsibilities was to develop our next generation of leaders. Twice a month, we had two brands that we ran separately. There were about 20 people on the senior leadership team between those two brands. And twice a month, I would take them separately. One of the businesses, they were headquartered in two different cities. So twice a month, I'd take those leadership teams into a conference room. I would assign pre-reading. I would assign questions on the pre-reading, and we'd have a very robust and open dialogue about the lessons that were learned from the reading and how they could apply those lessons to their function, whatever that was. And we had everybody from HR to marketing to production in those meetings. I have spent a good part of the latter part of my career in a mentoring role. I love mentoring. I love helping people figure out how to go about solving problems, because that's really what business is. It's a series of problems to be solved, whether that's a problem that a customer needs solved and a product that we might offer that solves that for the customer, or whether that's some internal problem that needs to be solved, a production issue, a go-to-market issue, you name it. It's just a series of problems that need to be solved. I'm a fan of the old proverb about teaching a man to fish versus giving a man a fish. And I think coaching is all about teaching people, men and women, how to fish. It's about asking the right questions to stimulate thoughtful, powerful, aggressive, goal-oriented leaders, asking the right questions to get them to come to the solutions for themselves, not giving them the solutions, but pointing them in the right direction, hopefully asking the right questions that will prompt them to come up with that decision on their own. And through that process of repetition, at some point, they don't need that prompting anymore. They've figured out how to ask themselves the right questions.
Greg, I appreciate you being on the show today. And for each of you listening, if you want to connect with Greg, you can just go to CEOcoachingInternational.com. You can get all the details about Greg and about this particular episode as well. So Greg, again, thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that, so please visit us at CEOcoachingInternational.com. We can then set up a call, and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.